Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Lecture Series, online edition. I'm Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator for the Institute, and I'd like to welcome all of you for joining us for tonight's presentation by one of ARI's friends and past speakers, Mr. Howard Shi. Howard is the Research and Policy Director for the Asian American Federation, responsible for the Federation's Census Information Center, CIC, which is officially designated by the Census Bureau as a repository of census data for improving data access to the underserved communities. Howard is the author and co-author of numerous reports on Asian Americans, including an analysis of city government funding to social service organizations serving Asian Americans in New York City, Making America Work, Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders in Workforce and Business, various profiles of Asian Americans in New York City, and the State of Asian American Children in 2014. He's also has published two articles in UCLA's AAPI Nexus Journal, one on poverty among Asian New Yorkers, and as the co-author comparing Asians in New York and LA metro areas. So today, Howard will be presenting on the recently ended 2020 census, next steps for New York City and the Asian American community. He previously presented at ARI back in February on the planned outreach of the Asian Pacific American Complete Count Committee, trying to do their planned outreach in the hard to count areas within New York City. However, the pandemic struck the very next month, causing everybody's plan, including the Census Bureau, to change significantly. And so Howard will be discussing with us how the pandemic affected census operations, deadlines, outreach to the community, and where we currently are in the tabulation process. And will the census meet its December 31st deadline to submit final numbers to the president? And so without further ado, please welcome Howard Shi.
When Anthony invited me to talk today, I was thinking, what should I entitle this talk? And I kind of felt that it sort of basically talk about the 2020 census and how we did. And I know that back in February, things were rosy. Everybody was excited and ready to go. And now we are in a completely different environment. So I'll talk a little bit about what Anthony said, what had happened, how did we respond, and then how are things going with the census going forward. A little bit more about the Federation. We were founded in 1989. We've been around for a long time, and we work with about 70 other Asian-serving community service organizations across New York City. And we do a lot of things besides research and, you know, the census and things like that. We do leadership trainings, capacity building, and mentorship to Asian community organizations. And like Anthony mentioned, we also operate a census information center, which provides access to and helps interpret data for the Asian community here. A little bit of a reminder of what was at stake with the census, why the census is so important. The census is used for reapportionment, and we'll talk a little bit about this that later on. And it's also used for redistricting, and that's coming up for New York State in the next year. In fact, the redistricting commission has been selected and is ready to start doing its job. The census data is also used for allocation of federal funds. The amount of money that comes to the state for Medicare or for TANF or for all sorts of different services and funding all rely on using census data to apportion the proper amount of money to each particular state. So it's really important to get the counts right. And finally, census is just important for representation, for people to see themselves as part of the United States. One of the first things that they can do is participate in the census. And so it's really important to be able to have as many people feel comfortable filling out the census and being seen and being visible. The census has had a lot of direct impacts on the Asian community in the past decade. A lot of the new census population data resulted in new funding for immigrant senior centers, for example. We were able to show the rapid growth in the Asian senior population and the the fact that they were largely immigrant and convinces the city to contribute new programs and dollars for senior centers. We also saw increased representation at all levels of government, including the first congressman member elected to the United States House of Representatives from the city of New York, growing representation in the state legislature and in the city council. The census data also feeds into another survey that the Census Bureau conducts called the American Community Survey. That survey is done every year, even between censuses. And it's actually the data that I personally use for my research at the Federation most often. And for example, the American Community Survey data collects data on the languages spoken by all the households and the individuals across the state, or a sample of them, so that it gives us the data to be able to advocate on behalf of our community and say that more language support is needed. And in fact, we're able to use the data to convince the city to expand the number of languages they cover from 6 to 10. And now the city provides, the city agencies are supposed to provide translated materials in Bengali, Chinese, Korean, and Urdu. We also saw, the population numbers were used to convince this New York City school system to adopt the Lunar New Year in Eid al-Fitr as holidays on the New York City school calendar. So census really impacts the daily lives of all of our communities and especially immigrant communities in New York City and Asian communities as well. And then a reminder, when we were last talking in February, the major challenges that we were facing were, how do we convince our communities who have historically not wanted to participate in the census to participate this time around? And we talked about the major challenges. There's lack of general awareness that this census is going on. There's, of course, language barriers, making sure that translated materials are available, translated forms are available. Fear and distrust of government. What is the government going to do with the data? Is it going to use it against me? Immigration enforcement concerns have always been an issue, but particularly with the Trump administration heading up or leading or administering the census, it became a really big concern in our communities. And then for the first time, the census was being conducted online. So computer literacy and adequate access to internet also became a concern, particularly among lower income communities and senior communities. And finally, a lot of people, even if they were assuaged by some of these other concerns, didn't necessarily see the value in participating in the census. And so we needed to get out a message that both allayed the concerns of community members, as well as showing how really beneficial participating in the census was. So we also talked about strategies, right? So we wanted to make sure, we found that just doing messaging research, that trusted voices are essential. We wanted to make sure we were working with ethnic media, community leaders, community organizations, such as the memberships, member agencies of the Federation, and generally looking for people who are influential on the opinions and thoughts of members of the community. There was messaging that was developed to address key concerns and also really show people what the value of the census is. We found that talking about education, talking about access to healthcare, all were very important messaging to help convince people to participate in the census. And then also making sure that there was translated materials and resources that were in language were available to everybody that was all the volunteers that were assembling to go out and do this. So first thing we wanted to do was organize, and we talked about the APA Complete Count Committee, but there are so many other organizing structures throughout New York City and New York State. For example, the New York Counts 2020 Coalition largely led by New York Immigration Coalition, and it was statewide. They provided a lot of training, a lot of coordination, a lot of advocacy for both city and state funding, which ended up coming down to help us community organizations do the work that we needed to do. At the national level for the Asian community, to count us in 2020, led by the Asian Americans Advancing Justice, AAJC, based in DC, provided a lot of translated materials and worked with APA Vote create a hotline for people to call in if they had questions and be able to answer questions in language. And of course, the New York City Census Office had a multi-million dollar campaign with advertising, working with volunteers, and also funding groups like us and other members of the APA Count Committee to do census outreach. So it was really important to make sure that we were communicating with each other and that we were doing either events jointly or making sure that we weren't, you know, overlapping or doing duplicative efforts. And so all of these things were really important. And having those relationships built up in February was really helpful in thinking about what we were going to do in March. And it actually ended up being really helpful in turning around in reacting to COVID, which really put a real major planning, you know, really caused us to change plans, and being able to have those coordinating links in place already was really invaluable in helping everybody pivot to the new virtual realities that we had to deal with. Oops, hold on. So, you know, sharing resources all through, you know, through the APA Complete Count Committee and through Count Us in 2020, things like scripts for talking to people were created in language. We had flyers and posters that we could share, that we could put up across our communities, sharing, that way we don't have to do translations ourselves, and we can not have to worry about design. We could just print these and share them. And these were all very, very helpful. And of course, the giveaways. And here are a couple examples of water bottles, but there are tons of things like keychains and umbrellas and other giveaways that were available, t-shirts and things like that. And they all helped people engage, right? People are always interested in, you know, if you give them something for free, they're a lot more likely to settle in and at least spend a few minutes listening to what you have to say. So finally, COVID. You know, I think, you know, last time I was here, it was in February, we were just ready to start ramping up. We actually had our first press conference with the APA Complete Count Committees early March in preparation for the March 12th release of the opening of the online response form. And then COVID hit about a week after they opened the portal for the for responding to the census. Everything basically shut down. All of the outreach work we had, like meetings planned and events planned, they just started, you know, even before the official shutdown, people were canceling. People were just, you know, worried and not wanting to do in-person stuff. So we had to pivot to virtual. There was always going to be a virtual component to our work, but we essentially went completely virtual. So fortunately, in New York City, the Census Office was able to pivot a lot of their funding away from, you know, for example, they had to stop doing subway ads because, you know, nobody was going on the subways anymore. And so they shifted resources from a variety of locations to start really ramping up the phone and text banking in the operations and made it open to all the partners. So we were able to do, you know, thousands and thousands of outreach. And I think it got to a point where people were getting kind of mad at us at the community, or at least certain members of being texted over and over again about the census. But I think that it was really important to sort of saturate the messaging and get it out there. We also became more reliant on social media, pivoting more to that and sharing the information and going to places where people were discussing and connecting, and also shifting to traditional media. So I think in February I'd mentioned that the Census Bureau had a multi-million dollar campaign to buy ads in ethnic media, but they had left out the South Asian community. Well, partly because we pushed them hard on that as the Asian American advocacy community, that they must do South Asian languages, but also, you know, the inability for both the Census Bureau employees to go out and talk to people in the South Asian community, as well as our partners that work with the South Asian community. Census Bureau devoted a lot more dollars to South Asian languages and began buying media in the summer, like in June and July, to do advertising in the South Asian media outlets. And I think New York City, as well as we at the Federation had some funding, we also began to advertise in those outlets that were missed initially by the Census Bureau. But gradually, you know, late in the summer, things started to reopen. We began planning in late July to start doing more in-person events, but much more socially, socially distanced in style. We also had to react to how people's lives had changed, right? People were no longer going to the movies, weren't going to restaurants, but they were going to places like food banks because a lot of people were out of, you know, we had unprecedented jobless rates, particularly in the Asian community. So food banks were a really important place to engage with people, healthcare settings, hospitals, doctors, offices, pharmacies were also important. And making sure that we had the safety equipment in place for our volunteers or our staff to be able to do this particular work. The COVID also had a tremendous impact on the timeline. We were supposed to be done with the census by essentially July 31st. We didn't get started on the census basically until July 31st. There was certainly the online option was open, but you'll see that response rates, which I'll go into a little bit later, certainly were not being helped by the fact that we weren't able to do in-person outreach. So the self-response timeline ended up being extended. Initially, it was to October 31st, and the Trump administration decided to accelerate the census because they wanted to make sure that they could get the numbers in under the Trump presidency. So they tried to end the census early on September 30th. There were court cases by states by advocacy organizations to push it back to the original October 31st deadline. There was a stay on the Census Bureau ending on September 30th, which resulted ultimately in the census ending on October 15th, when the Supreme Court removed the stay on, I believe, October 12th or 13th, somewhere like that, finally allowing this Trump administration to end the census early. So we did get an extra 2 weeks to promote the census. There was a lot of activity to remind people that they could still apply for the census. We did a lot of out in the community events, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Field operations were also scheduled to start around, I believe it was mid-April, end of April. Field operations, meaning the Census Bureau would go knock on doors for households that didn't respond online at that point. So those were all put off essentially until August 1st. And then, as a consequence, the Census Bureau ended up with less time to cover more households because than in 2010, right? So in 2010, they basically had May, June, and July to do the headcount. But this time in around in 2020, they had August and September plus half of October. So they, and to be honest, they were winding down operations around September, but because, you know, it takes time to wind things down, but the court stay came in. So then they extended it a little bit, but they had already let go of some staff. So they obviously weren't going full steam ahead in the 2 weeks that they got in October. So that that change in the timeline is worrisome in terms of impacting the quality of the census, just by sheer growth in the population. Even though I think overall we had a self-response rate comparable to 2010, just because of the growth in the population, the total number of households that the Census Bureau had to end up knocking on the doors of was increased, and they had to do it with less staff and they had to do it in less time. Although I believe they tried to hire more and more people, but it was really hard because a lot of the traditional sources of employees were reluctant to come out, right? So seniors who wanted to, you know, get some extra money, and doing this, you know, doing the door knocking, were reluctant to come out. And so, you know, you ended up with a smaller pool of people that they were able to pull from. And so I already talked about the Trump administration's constant changes in the timeline, right? So there were first the extension, then the shortening of the census. And we'll see that also in the release of the data. The challenges that the Census Bureau is going to have in processing the data in a shorter amount of time than they traditionally have had. How did we, so, you know, ultimately it was about reaching out to the community members. And so we had events that we got new media coverage, news coverage. We both did. On the left here, you see volunteers at our bike caravan in Chinatown. We got some donations from City Bike for passes that we gave to the volunteers so that they could do a ride through Chinatown with stops at various locations where we had tables set up with Census Bureau employees and volunteers to talk to people, to convince them to fill out the census. We had giveaways there. And the bike caravans, the bikers would go from station to station and draw attention to the fact that these tables were there. What the Census Bureau ended up calling mobile census questionnaire assistance centers. And so, you know, we got press coverage. We used the fact that we had a lot of people riding around on bikes in a group wearing t-shirts to draw attention to the census. We also had reports that talked about the progress that the community was making in the self-response rates, and we got coverage in the media about that as well. We did paid advertising, as I mentioned before. We did it in language, so we got a South Asian, the Urdu News here on the left. We also did it online through the advertising. This is the News India Times. You'll see both our ad and an ad from New Jersey as well. So, you know, we had a lot of different, a lot of people were reaching out to people in all sorts of different ways. And it's really, there was certainly a lot of money beyond just the Census Bureau itself that was spent this time around on reaching out to ethnic media. We also did a lot of virtual events, right? So the example here on the left is we worked with a councilman over in Jersey City to have a Facebook Live event to talk about the importance of the census. We had different experts come on to talk about how census impacts Jersey City. And we had different community leaders speak up at the Facebook Live event as well. And, you know, Zoom was a fact of life. We did, you know, all sorts of different webinars and live events through Zoom. And we also did social media. On the right here was a social media ad that we put together for our social media outlets that was emphasizing the importance of the census data in terms of how healthcare dollars and, you know, for the lack of a healthcare in general is allocated. I think we also pivoted to doing messaging around how census data is used in combating pandemics, right? How the eventual vaccine would be allocated based on population of each state, how hospitals rely on the data to be able to estimate how many beds that they need to have, sorts of things like that. So really tying the message to what was happening in current events and trying to draw the line between what was happening to in communities and the importance of census data. I mentioned before we did socially distance in-person events. On the top left is a outdoor press conference that we did to alert the community that the Census Bureau staff was going to go out and start knocking on doors. This happened, I believe, in August. We had, this was the APA Complete Count Committee. We had had a car there. We had Chaya was there. Chaya CDC. Who else is there? Amin Kwan. And also Drum. This was in Jackson Heights. We had press come out. We did it socially distanced. We did use the microphone. Everyone was wearing masks. And we got some really decent press coverage about the importance of the census and the fact that the Census Bureau employees are coming out. And we had the Census Bureau staff come out, and the regional director was there as well to talk about the importance of the census and the safety and all the precautions that were in place. On the top right is a table with we have giveaways, and we also have Census Bureau staff there that would help people fill out the form and submit it online right there and then. And we'd be, you know, I think this was happening in Flushing. We did a bunch of different events. We actually had some giveaways in terms of like free ice cream at the Flushing Ice Cream Factory, or free dim sum, or free dessert at a bakery. We also did a, on the bottom left is a car caravan. So similar to the bike caravan I mentioned before, this is in Sunset Park, where we drove around Sunset Park on the active main streets, where a lot of people were you know, coming out on a warm summer day on the weekend to do their grocery shopping and that kind of thing. And we, again, along the route had different locations where people could interact with volunteers, and also had Census Bureau staff to be able to take people's information right there and then, and have it protected by the Census Bureau data processes. So, and then, you know, on the right, there were rallies and marches. This one was organized by the New York City Census Office across the Brooklyn Bridge. Again, to highlight the fact that the, you know, census is ongoing. You know, usually it would have ended by July 31st, but we really needed to let people know that it was still going on, that it was still important to participate, and that that, you know, and let them know that the Census Bureau was coming out to knock on doors. So what ended up happening? I think there's good news, and then there's some news that is also worrisome. So I'll talk a little bit about self-response rates. This is the first measure that we have of what, how, you know, how well the census did. One of the things to keep in mind is that it's not, self-response rates are not a ultimate measure of quality. It's only lets us know how well we did in convincing people to fill out the form themselves, because studies have shown that self-response is the best way to get the most accurate information out of households. You know, essentially, once you have somebody going and knocking on the door, you're starting to play the game of telephone, right? So there's always going to be the risk of some sort of error when somebody's telling somebody else some information to record. So what we wanted to make sure is that we got self-response rates as high as possible. So overall in the Asian community across the United States, we did pretty well. We had the highest at 71.3, if you look at the bottom. We had the highest self-response rates of any major race and ethnic group in the country. But if you dive a little bit deeper, you'll see that you have Asians outperforming all other race groups in rural areas, in small towns, in the suburbs, essentially, and in medium cities. So you'll see non-Hispanic white at 72.1% for medium cities, Asians 75.2% for medium cities. Once you get to large cities, the self-response rates for Asians declines, and declines relative to the other groups. So here it's 69% versus 70%, not that bad for large cities, but then in the largest cities, we got a 2% difference, 66% between non-Hispanic whites and 64% for Asians. So, you know, that's always the challenge, because when we look at, we're really doing a really good job counting sort of the Asians that are living in suburbs, that are well-educated, that have probably better English skills. But then in the urban areas where you tend to find lower skilled Asians with higher poverty rates and less English skills, those are the ones that are hard to reach. And we did a fairly good job, but we still underperformed, relative to non-Hispanic whites. Taking a deeper dive, we also did, I want to preface that this data came from the Census Hard to Count maps run by the CUNY Grad Center, and they did an excellent job of providing tons of data for community groups in terms of planning and just letting us know what was happening and keeping track of what was going on in the community. The rest of the is the charts that I'm going to provide are analysis that we did at the Federation to look at how Asians were doing in New York City. So we followed a similar process that the methodology that the CUNY Grad Center did and looked at. In this case, we looked at census tracts that were 50% or more Asian. So we said, okay, well, that if we look at the weighted average self-response rates for that group of census tracts, we'll get a good picture of what's happening in the Asian community. So we'll see that essentially before we went out to do more in-person socially distant activities, Asians were lagging behind the rest of New York City. On July 31st, the self-response rates for those particular tracts was at 53.3%. And that was below the overall New York City self-response rate. So then 2.5 months later, as the census was winding down on the 14th of October, you see that Asians now had a higher self-response rate than the rest of New York City at 62.4 versus 61.5. You see it's due to the rate of change on the third column, excuse me. So that's good news. I think that shows how important it was to be able to do face-to-face discussions with communities that were harder to reach, that weren't connected, that weren't hearing all of the messaging and weren't necessarily convinced that the census was really important. But having somebody just merely engage with them and talk from a trusted organization to talk about the census really improved our self-response rates within the city. And see that we also saw something similar in neighborhoods with a lot of Asians, right? We picked a bunch of different neighborhoods that had either, that were more likely to have Asians in them than other places. And we see that, the New York City overall had a change in increase in self-response rate of about 7%. We see essentially, Asian communities exceeding that with exception of a few of them, Coney Island and Brighton Beach, but those are less concentrations of Asians compared to places like Chinatown, which saw almost a 8.7% increase of in self-response rates. So, we're being able to go out in August and September to do live in-person events in the community where they were was really essential to making sure Asian Americans were counted. Oops. Oh, there we go. And then we also looked at self-response rates by Asian groups. Again, this time we were looking at census tracts that were 20% or more of each of these ethnicities, because there weren't enough census tracts that were, 50% Bangladeshi or greater. So we still could get a sense of where, how well the Asian community, Asian ethnic groups were doing for some of the larger groups. You can see that all of those tracts saw well above the 7% citywide self-response rate changes. We had a lot of, if you remember going back, it was like 53% citywide rates. I think the only groups, Koreans and Pakistanis, were above the citywide rate in July. But by the end, I think all of the groups, with exception of maybe Indian, were Indian and Filipino were above the citywide rate. I think, let me just check, 61.5. Yeah. So, or at least they closed the gap pretty well. So that's that really shows the effectiveness of doing in-person outreach. So what's next? Census Bureau has basically said that they're not going to make the statutory deadline of December 31st for giving to the president to give to Congress the state total populations for reapportionment. And reapportionment, I'll remind you, is basically the reallocation of congressional seats in the House of Representatives. And for that, they just need the total number of people within that state. There's also an ongoing Supreme Court challenge to the Trump administration's attempt to subtract away, I think, undocumented or maybe even non-citizen data from the reapportionment totals and subsequently for the data, the more detailed data for redistricting. I don't know when the ruling on that is coming out. The Supreme Court has heard the case already and is deliberating. And I'm just trying to remember when the term is coming to the end. But it, from the lines of questioning that the justices were giving, they seem to be disinclined from doing that because there's a tremendous amount of history and precedent that reapportionment is done on whole persons living in the United States. It says nothing about citizenship. It says nothing. In fact, they're very specific about only two, well, at least the Constitution is specific about two different groups in terms of how they would be counted. One is, slaves, the Three-Fifths Compromise, and also Native Americans not taxed. So it's pretty clear that, from the Constitution that redistricting and reapportionment, at least at the federal level, must include everybody that is a resident of the United States. So we'll see what the Supreme Court says. Most of us following it are hopeful that it'll remain the same. As for the rest of the data, the Census Bureau typically takes about a year or two to process everything and create the published tables and release everything. So given the delay that's happening in the processing of the census, and I'll go into that in a little bit, It will probably be 2022 before we get all of the data that the Census Bureau traditionally releases with a decennial census. So what's holding up the process? One thing is that the Bureau just needs time to process these things. And I think the second issue is that with the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of shift in where people were living. And there is a lot of duplicate errors, I think, that the Census Bureau needs to, and they call it anomalies, but basically they're seeing, we have this person's name, same birth date, but filled out on two different forms. And this happens a lot, particularly with college students, where parents will put them out on the form at their home, but the census residency rules require that they fill out for their dorms. And also the ruling was that, even though a lot of colleges shut down and sent people home, the college students should still be filling out the census at where they would have been on April 1st. Because, long term for planning purposes and for representational purposes, they're kind of like a stand-in for the, all of the different college students that would be there. So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot more confusion this time around on that particular issue, but certainly other group quarters had issues in terms of who should be counted where. And I think the Census Bureau has probably more cases than in 2010 that they have to go through. And again, because the Trump administration wants to rush the numbers out, they have less time because they only started processing the data in October, when they traditionally start processing the data in August. So obviously, even if they go as fast as they can, they're not going to be able to get through all of the duplicate errors, not errors, but all the duplicates, and resolve all of the quote-unquote anomalies before they can have an accurate count. Another part of the delay, and certainly the redistricting data, is that the Census Bureau is implementing a very complex algorithm for privacy protection. It's called differential privacy, and it basically says that there is a mathematical way to assure a certain level of privacy based on a mathematical algorithm. The challenge is that when they produced a demonstration product last September, they ended up producing a product that showed widely diverging, and they used it on the 2010 census data to demonstrate the viability of the product. They showed a huge discrepancy and shift in the population of the United States, because they're basically trying to disguise values of small populations by shifting populations around geographically. And so what you ended up with a major skewing of the 2010 data that really concerned a lot of data users, because if you end up misrepresenting what a neighborhood or a city's population really is, you end up jeopardizing federal funding, particularly, around healthcare or education. And so they've been slowly trying to improve the algorithm. They've made some progress, but it's taken time. And I believe some of the decision making points, what they were going to do on this particular procedure, have also been pushed back as well. So that'll also delay a lot of the ultimate processing and producing of the data. And then finally, what's next is the Census Bureau. I say usually here, but I'm not sure how, given that they had to truncate a lot of their processes, if they will be able to successfully do an estimate of the undercount of communities. Traditionally, what they do is, in parallel, they will run a double-checking survey of the census to go back to certain households and say, did we really get an accurate result on the census? and then use that to develop an undercount or an overcount in some cases. And, you know, it's really important because that analysis basically pointed out which areas we needed to focus on. Right? So, you know, African American communities, Latino communities, low-income Asians, households with small children, and different things like that. And so I'm hoping that the Bureau was able to do that. I haven't heard exactly what their timetable is on that, but I think that's another thing that we will be waiting for, is that Census Bureau evaluation of how well or how accurate they think the 2020 census is going to be. So with that, I'm going to stop my share and just, you know, that's basically where we're at right now. We're waiting to see how the totals are going to come out. We're waiting to see whether or not the Supreme Court makes a particular decision about how redistricting and reapportionment occur, and we're eagerly awaiting the results of the census. And there are ways that we can look at different sources of information to see if the census is meeting what we expected, and we'll be looking forward to that evaluation process. I think there's going to be a lot more scrutiny just because of COVID. And because of all the different things that had happened, including like the citizenship question and all sorts. It's been certainly a chaotic census, decennial census this time around.
In terms of the president wanting to exclude undocumented people from the count, how is that possible in terms of the census, since everybody gets counted and there's no census, citizenship question on it? How is it possible right. You could exclude people?
Sure. So what the president, or to be more accurate, the Secretary of Commerce directed the Census Bureau to do is to create a separate estimate using, immigration data, using, I think they were also attempting to use driver's license data, but basically, you know, the majority of states said no to that, to create an estimate of how many bond citizens or undocumented citizens were living in each census block. So it is possible to create that kind of an estimate and use that to subtract out. But obviously, that would be litigated like crazy in terms of, you know, is the information accurate and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's essentially the process the Bureau was going to do to create the estimates that they were directed to do.
I see. In terms of the census end deadline for the operations itself, I believe only Justice Sotomayor was the one who dissented on the decision not to sort of end the deadline early versus the rest of the other justices. Why didn't the census, Bureau just keep on going all the way to the end of their original, proposed deadline of October 31st? This administration who said that the count wouldn't be, accurately tabulated on time, even with the earlier deadline.
The Trump administration ordered the Census Bureau to end early. And so, they have to do as the president directs, right? So they were kind of out of options. I think also they were under pressure to, be able to produce the numbers by December 31st because Congress didn't act to remove the statutory deadline. So they still have to make the best faith effort to produce those numbers. So they needed time to process the data. So if you're still collecting information, you can't process the information. And so, I think that was kind of, they were trying to make trade-offs between collecting more information and being able to have enough time to process towards a particular statutory deadline. which they knew they weren't going to make, but they had to make a big good faith effort towards it. Otherwise, you know, essentially they're actively violating federal law. So it's kind of, you know, they're caught. The Bureau was caught in a bind. So what they really needed, it was Congress to give them an extension to be able to do all of this stuff, but they never got it. So they're doing the best that they can.
In terms of the census operations, the non-response follow-up, there was an article, I believe, either it was Vox or CNN back in like October when the deadline was ending, how census enumerators were discussing how they were not fully prepared for what was going to happen when they were out there in the field. I mean, were there things that you heard in New York City in terms of, you know, field, you know, enumerators saying that they weren't prepared, you know, there might be ways that the count might not be accurate in terms of the processes that happen?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, so we have to, I know that there was a, you know, the Census Bureau has basically said, oh, we got, you know, 99.9% of households. Well, that doesn't mean that we got them accurately, right? So, you know, so the staff, the process is they'll knock on the door a couple of times. If they don't get a response, they'll ask a neighbor. They can't get a response from the neighbor, they'll ask the landlord, they'll ask anybody for any indication of who's in there. But, you know, somebody outside who's not familiar with it, they can say, oh, I see like two people coming in and out, but they might miss a newborn baby, right? So all of that aside is that, you know, the Bureau may have said that we got every single household counted, but only because, but doesn't mean that they got them counted accurately. And that's why the self-response rate is so important. So we got, you know, for New York City, we basically have over close to 40% of the households at risk of being miscounted, right? So I think that's, you know, one of the major concerns about the process is because not only did the Bureau have less time to be able to do all of the multiple visits that are sometimes necessary to get a household counted, COVID has created a lot of changes in how people are living, right? People don't leave their houses, so nobody knows who's in, you know, in a particular apartment, or a lot of people suddenly had to double up because of rents. And so there's a lot of concern about the accuracy of the census. But I think you were asking about how prepared census employees were. I think
logistics-wise, did you, you know, sort of, I mean, different organizations such as yours, right? I mean, did you have input into how the processes were going to be? And then afterwards, you know, when it actually was implemented out in the field, did you see like certain flaws to it? You know, how, you know, they could do better in the next decade, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to get out the count?
I think it's going to be hard to draw new lessons because COVID just created so many special circumstances, right? You know, with, I know the Bureau, the couple of changes that they did in terms of the in-person door knocking operations, right? So they taught they obviously provided personal protective and equipment to the people that were knocking on doors, but they also taught them to knock on the door and immediately step back 6 feet. They also taught them to be flexible and say, if the person behind the door doesn't want to open the door, offer them, you know, their census issued phone number so that they can call them and they'll just do it over the phone, like with the door in between them and things like that. I think some of the challenges were that the Census Bureau had a difficult time filling certain language needs, as always. And so I know one thing that I heard is the Bureau was trying to get people that were supposed to be working and based in Queens to go to Brooklyn, for example, to address some of the language issues. I know that that there were some employees that because there's some employees that didn't have enough to do, and there's some employees that had almost too much to do just because of the misbalance in sort of the languages and the skills. So I know that there were people that were ultimately not laid off, but let go because they were kind of didn't have a need for their skill set to do some of that stuff. So there was a lot of mismatch of skills and needs in terms of how the census was being done in the field. I think that they ultimately also, one of the problems is that they were hiring in February for work in, you know, April, May, and June and July, right? But then they ended up having to push everything back. So people weren't able to like wait that long or had other things that they were going to do when August rolled around. So there were a lot of like COVID specific issues in terms of how the census was being done that, I mean, I guess the thing would be to have better contingency plans for like natural disasters or pandemics and things like that. So that's probably the biggest lesson that you can draw from all these operations. But all of these other issues were similar in 2010, right? Making sure you hire from the community, you hire enough people with the language skills. You make sure that you allow people that are not necessarily citizens but are work eligible to be hired and that kind of thing. And so a lot of that stuff, you know, a lot of those issues still remain. And the Bureau does the best they can to navigate around federal employment regulations and issues.
I think one of the complaints in the article I read was just basically that training was inadequate for them. I mean, basically they came in, got their equipment, and then were sent home to do their training online by themselves, and then having to do a group phone call and, you know, just to do a sort of basic run through of the different questions they had to go through on their smartphone that they were going to take out into the field, and then, you know, they were just thrown into the water like that.
Yeah, I think... There are a couple of people that I talked to that were actually census enumerators as well. I think, you know, it was certainly challenging learning in that environment, but I think the people that I talked to didn't, you know, they worked through it and they were, you know, was sort of, I think it depends on a person's learning style, right? So I don't think the Bureau ever intended to go completely offline like that for the training. They just had to do it because I know that I got calls from the Census Bureau all the time saying, hey, we're looking for space to bring people in to do training. Do you have any of it? So that ultimately, I don't think they were able to find all of those spaces because people, you know, community spaces weren't open to be able to do in-person training. So I'm not sure. Yeah, so there's a lot to be. So I think certain people just don't learn well that way, and that may have impacted their feeling of how prepared they are, and certainly that's something that the Bureau needs to address. But I also think that it's so COVID specific that I can't really say that, yeah, you know, Bureau, you did a terrible job. I think that, you know, it's something that they need. So they need to make sure that they don't, you know, there's always a temptation to shift to completely virtual or online training, and I think that I think they will, certainly this experience hopefully will give them pause from doing it in 2030.
In terms of the technology, I mean, the pandemic happened, and then being able to do it online certainly was a positive part of, you know, this decade's census. Did a majority of the people that did the self-response rate do it online or turn in back paper or do the phone call? Do you happen to have those sort of breakdowns? I mean, was it relatively successful doing it online this time around?
I think so. From the numbers that I saw, and it's also available on the Census Bureau's website, is they tell you how many people fill it out online. And I think the vast majority of people, there's certainly certain areas like rural communities that they weren't going to ever do it online because they don't have connections. But I think certainly in most of New York, people fill it out online. And I didn't hear about, you know, crashes on the network or security issues. And so they really wanted to make sure that those issues never happened based on like the ACA experience that the federal government had back in 2012. And so I think they were hyper sensitive to that particular. So they had that part covered. I think the bigger concern is, you know, being able to connect with populations that don't have internet connection, and those, you know, seniors or low-income communities and things like that. And so I think one of the things, the biggest complaints is that the Bureau needs to make sure that they have an adequate plan in place to reach out to those communities. And I think one of the things that they were kind of successful, but it was kind of could have been planned better, was the mobile questionnaire assistance centers. We were working closely with them, and we had tremendous, you know, we'd have an event and we get like a 60 to 100 people to respond to the census at over a couple hours, you know, based in like East Harlem or Sunset Park and things like that. So, you know, but the challenge there is that the staff that were manning those were not, didn't actually sign up to do those. They were originally hired to do employment outreach into the community. And then because of COVID happened, they took all of those people who were, you know, probably not going to stay on much longer because they had already, they were supposed to have finished by, you know, all the hiring by April, right? So those people would have gone on to do other things. And so because of the sudden demand for mobile questionnaire assistance centers, a lot of those people were turned into, you know, going out in the community, and they weren't really, didn't necessarily have the skill set to, you know, walk up to strangers and get them to fill out the census. And so that's why our partners came in. And so partnering our volunteers to talk to those people was really important in order to, you know, just draw people in. So otherwise they would just sit there and nobody would come to them. That's a big challenge.
I see. Well, okay. So one final question. In terms of outreach, of those people who still didn't answer the census, what was sort of like the main reasons that they, you know, this time around, still after so much messaging, advertisement, outreach and stuff like that, they still don't want to answer the census? And how can we, you know, better outreach to them in, you know, 10 years from now?
You know, it's hard to know exactly what they're thinking because they weren't engaging, right? So I think that, I think ultimately it becomes an issue, a broader issue of civic engagement in general, right? So it doesn't really help to do this, trying to convince people to do something that's civically positive once every 10 years. We really need to be engaging with people all decade long, and just, you know, helping them realize that there is a way to participate civically and, you know, having their voices heard when, you know, before decisions are made on their behalf and things like that. How do you engage with your community boards? How do you talk to your city council member or your state legislature? How do you, you know, how do you more broadly function as a member of this community, of the broader community? And so, and then we can, as you build the trust of either community organizations or leaders, build that trust. Then when it comes time, 10 years from now, to say, hey, you know, we've been talking all this time, you know, remember, you know, now it's time to do the census. That's just another civic engagement activity rather than trying to do this huge push once every 10 years. And I think there's a lot of talk in the community about making sure that we try to extend some of the gains that we've made in interacting with the community and sort of keep the momentum going. We obviously won't be able to do the big push that, you know, that we did for the census, but I think we can still do a lot of the littler things to maintain connections with, you know, the harder to reach members of our community.
Well, thank you very much, Howard, for indulging us with all this updated information regarding the census. We look forward to, I mean, the results of the census to see whether or not the Asian American population grew, shrank, moved, etc. And, you know, I mean, today's the debut of the American Community Survey. I'm sure you're going to be sifting through that over the weekend during the holidays to see, you know, the data from, you know, the past 5 years and stuff. And, you know, I'm sure you'll be picking up a lot of, you know, different tidbits.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, we will be. Yep. Thank you. Thank you again for the venue. It's always it's great to see you again in certainly these uncertain times. So take care of yourself and have a good break.